the hostile as well. The stock market declined, and across the north and at the battlefront, some Union soldiers initially declared their hostility to fighting to free black people. The proclamation was openly ridiculed among McClellan's officers. But overall, the northern reaction to this revolutionary shift in the purpose of the war was positive. Democratic Party papers mocked the proclamation as mere paper thunder or as radical fanaticism, social revolution, and gross unconstitutionality. Republican papers, however, rejoiced, declaring it the beginning of the end of the rebellion, the beginning of the new life of the nation. Among Republican politicians, enthusiasm soared, although some wished for a more unconditional assault on slavery. Massachusetts Governor John Andrew wanted more, but distinguished between the text and its ultimate meaning in a telling observation. It is a poor document, but a mighty act. Slow, somewhat halting, wrong in its delay till January, but grand and sublime after all. At the front lines, many Union soldiers now saw some kind of reality beneath their endless campfire conversations about the military necessity of emancipation. In Rochester, Douglas sat at his editor's desk, as he did so often, looked out on the war, and tried to speak for 4 million slaves, converting despair into hope. "We shout for joy that we live to record this righteous decree." Acknowledging Lincoln's cautious, forbearing, and hesitating way, he seized on the words, "forever free," and urged all to join the long-enslaved millions in honoring and celebrating this hour of deliverance. Douglas expressed new confidence in Lincoln in words very different from a month earlier. "Abraham Lincoln may be slow. Abraham Lincoln may desire peace even at the price of leaving our terrible sore untouched. But Abraham Lincoln is not the man to reconsider, retract, and contradict words and purposes solemnly proclaimed over his official signature." The duty of hope soared with new energy. "Confide in his word," Douglas advised about Lincoln, all the while falling back, as before, on faith in events greater than the president, events which have slowly wrung this proclamation from him. Douglas also placed new faith in the document's implied meanings, especially Lincoln's apparent decision to put aside border state influence, as well as half-loyal Democrats who claimed to be Unionists. And if some Union enlisted men and officers threw down their arms and refused to fight to free the slaves, Douglas concluded, so be it. Let the army be cleansed from all such pro-slavery vermin. The editor allowed himself to believe that the war he had advocated was now at hand, especially if Northerners would let the black man have an arm as well as a heart in this war. "Gird your loins," Douglas urged, "for the last struggle with the monster slavery." In the fall congressional elections of 1862, the Democrats made sweeping gains. Republicans suffered at the polls because of emancipation, and a depressed Lincoln, as numerous biographers have suggested, did not know quite where to turn. Northern voters were also prompted by a drumbeat in the press over fears of slave insurrection, by resistance to Lincoln's suspension of habeas corpus, and to arrests of newspaper editors, as well as by virulently racist Democratic Party rhetoric about emancipation leading to scenes of lust and rapine in the South, and a swarthy inundation of black workers into the North. In the anxious 100 days between the preliminary and final Emancipation Proclamations, jubilation gave way to confusion in abolitionist and free black communities. Above all, the news never abated about Lincoln and his men still planning for colonization. In late September cabinet meetings, Lincoln pushed his ministers to continue the effort for voluntary removal. And by November, he still hoped privately to make colonization in Central America a reality. Douglas exhibited a strikingly new mood in the fall of 1862, even about the dreaded bugbear of colonization. By November, he published contradictory reports about the state of colonization schemes still percolating from Washington. In one brief column, he said that Pomeroy's expedition to Panama was soon to depart, and that some black monitors should accompany the emigrants. But in an adjoining, longer piece, He claimed that his contacts in high authority had informed him that the Central American expedition had been canceled. Douglas editorialized, as though still trying to convince his own sons not to leave, that colonization made no sense economically. "In America," said the editor, "blacks are the workers. They had built the nation's wealth, and it was wasteful and ruinous to deport them now." For Douglas, his family, and the entire abolitionist community, the fall of 1862 was a sleepless watch night that lasted 3 months. "The next 2 months," Douglas wrote in November, "must be regarded as more critical and dangerous than any similar period during the slaveholders' rebellion. The apprehension," he said, "felt far more political than military." Douglas threw himself into the election fray as a partisan Republican. The biggest enemy at that moment, he argued, were Northern Democrats. Douglas asserted that a vote for Democrats in the congressional elections was a vote for Jefferson Davis and his rebel government. Instinctively impatient, Douglas urged Lincoln to abandon the grace period for Confederate repentance and proclaim immediate emancipation. Lincoln's proclamation had given Douglas a new political voice as an American nationalist. "Liberty and country first," he wrote. "Everything else afterward." He had indeed found the new politics he had sought for a decade. Douglas further took heart from reports he'd received about liberated slaves swarming into contraband camps established by the War Department around the rim of the South. A correspondent, H. Oscar, wrote to Douglas from Cairo, Illinois, located at the confluence of the Ohio and Mississippi rivers, rejoicing that "it begins to look as though the Jubilee sure enough had come in this country. The old barracks of the town were full of black refugees, yet still they come. Every morning a new contingent of freed people, men and women of all ages and all colors, appeared on the levee, seeking shelter, and asking about jobs and wages. The contrabands faced considerable white hostility, however, in the surrounding community. Oscar reported a rape of a black woman by 3 white men. Douglas also kept up a fervent correspondence about emancipation and a fundraising campaign with his British friends. Constantly, his paper needed money to survive, and he received numerous small contributions throughout 1862 from Julia Crofts's network of supporters. In October, Douglas wrote a public letter to his British and Irish friends, in which he gushed with new hope for the cause, gratitude for past financial and moral resources, and made an aggressive appeal for more money. Douglas became a one-man political action committee for emancipation. He expressed special thanks for all the support over the years for the Underground Railroad, but as of September 22nd, he remarked, its agents were out of employment. With Lincoln's proclamation, Douglas assured his foreign readers America had started the first chapter of a new history. "Now was the time for continued aid," said the editor, "with bills to pay and a thrilling new revolution to lead." "The end is not yet," he cautioned. "We are at best only at the beginning of the end." The following month, Douglas, the cheerleader, proclaimed the preliminary proclamation, the nation's moral bombshell, shaking everything into new forms. Rumors of slave insurrections in Virginia, he maintained, terrified the Confederate leadership and would well-nigh paralyze Lee and Cornwall Jackson, Stonewall Jackson, in ensuing campaigns. The war propagandist had found a new argument, even a new sense of humor. Douglas falsely said he would regret such insurrections, even as he hoped they would be formidable if they must occur. The wait for January 1st was almost unbearable, especially when Douglas read Lincoln's annual message in December, in which he forthrightly appealed yet again for colonization to accompany emancipation, reminding the nation that he could not make it better known than it already is that I strongly favor colonization. But so long conditioned for less than full measures of change from history or from Providence, Douglas journeyed to Boston for New Year's Day, and a planned celebration like no other. A highbrow event took place at Boston's Music Hall, with many of New England's most famous literati in attendance, including Henry Wadsworth Longfellow, Oliver Wendell Holmes, Charles Eliot Norton, John Greenleaf Whittier, Edward Everett Hale, Francis Parkman, and Ralph Waldo Emerson. Harriet Beecher Stowe sat prominently in the balcony. Emerson read some original verses for the occasion. In a transcendent moment, the throng of hundreds rhythmically called for Mrs. Stowe to stand and bow to resounding cheers. Then an orchestra played Mendelssohn's Hymn of Praise, followed by a rousing rendition of Beethoven's Fifth Symphony. A day for poetry and song, indeed, as Douglas had anticipated. But beginning at 10 a.m., a largely black organized meeting assembled throughout the day, reaching approximately 3,000 people at the magnificent Tremont Temple. Presided over in the early hours by black Garrisonians William Cooper Nell and Charles Lennox Remond, the speeches, poetry, and singing were confidently joyous. Garrison himself attended the upper crust event at the music hall, perhaps letting his old enemy from Rochester have that Tremont platform to himself. William Wells Brown, yet another old rival of Douglas's, delivered a rousing autobiographical tribute to the enterprise and self-reliance of former slaves all over the country. Douglas was the final speaker at the afternoon session. He alluded with irony to 2 years earlier when he and others had been driven from that same stage by a mob prepared to kill abolitionists. He honored the slaves of the South for their forbearance in not rising in insurrection, and appealed for what he hoped would be the imminent enlistment of black men in the Union armies. On behalf of abolitionists, he boasted that their warning, delivered for decades, was now coming to fruition in the blood of the moment, as he also predicted much more blood to come. Douglas soared, assuring the audience they had lived through a period of darkness into the dawn of light. His final refrains were constantly punctuated by shouts of Amen and Bless the Lord. After a break, the huge crowd grew even larger for the nighttime celebration and the anticipated news of Lincoln signing the final proclamation. But a mood of anxiety and doubt set in throughout the hall as the evening hours crept by without the word. The organizers maintained a group of runners to and from the telegraph office in downtown Boston. They all awaited, as Douglas remembered, the first flash of the electric wires. Their emotions danced between hope and fear. Would Lincoln indeed sign the wonderful decree? Would it be altered? Would there be some last-minute compromise in Washington, or even with the Confederacy? Rumor and experience pushed back constantly against analysis and biblical expectation of the Jubilee. Amid all the restlessness, Wells Brown and Douglas both got control of the audience and kept up a hopeful but strained rhetoric. Every moment of waiting chilled our hopes, Douglas recalled years later. 8, 9, 10 o'clock came and went, and still no word. With a visible shadow falling over the crowd, Douglas said, a man finally stepped hastily through the crowd and shouted, "It is coming! It is on the wires!" He was immediately followed by someone who tried to read some portion of the text of the Emancipation Proclamation, but was quickly drowned out by shouting and a scene wild and grand. In the next hour, Douglas hugged perhaps more people than he had before in his entire life, some of whom were old enemies. That night, there were no Garrisonian or anti-Garrisonian tears. An old preacher named Rue stood front and center with Douglas as they led the assembled in the anthem, "Blow ye the trumpet, blow," and repeated the verse, "Sound the loud timbrel o'er Egypt's dark sea. Jehovah hath triumphed, his people are free." According to witnesses, Douglas's baritone had never been in better form. Tremont Temple had been hired only until midnight. But at that hour, most of the celebrants decided to reassemble at the 12th Baptist Church on Phillip Street in Beacon Hill, the black section of Boston, a 20-minute walk away. Douglas and the revelers, singing, humming, shouting, walked out onto Tremont Street into a gentle, glistening snowfall to march to what all called the Fugitive Slaves Church. What swirling memories transported them along only they could tell. At the church, they were welcomed by its minister of many years, Leonard A. Grimes, who oversaw an all-night celebration of music and refreshments. "At Grimes's church," said Douglas, "we got into such a state of enthusiasm that almost everything seemed to be witty and appropriate to the occasion." Sometime near dawn, in exhausted jubilation, Douglas walked out of the church amid the quiet snowflakes and headed, bleary-eyed, to the train station. In Life and Times, he remembered the meaning of that night with his own poetry. It was not logic, but the trump of jubilee, which everybody wanted to hear. We were waiting and listening as for a bolt from the sky which would rend the fetters of 4 million of slaves. We were watching, as it were, by the dim light of the stars, for the dawn of a new day. We were longing for the answer to the agonizing prayers of centuries. Remembering those in bonds, as bound with them, we wanted to join in the shout for freedom and in the anthem of the redeemed. At that moment, and for its duration, the cruel and apocalyptic war had become holy. Chapter 19. Men of Color to Arms. During times of peace, the sons bury their fathers, but in war, it is the fathers who send their sons to the grave. Herodotus, The History. In 1863, more than ever, the Civil War became a family affair for Frederick Douglass and his household with 4 unmarried adult children. Lewis and Charles Douglass, at the ages of 22 and 18, enlisted in the 54th Massachusetts Regiment in March, recruited personally by their father. Charlie, my youngest son, was the first to put his name down as one of the company, Douglas wrote to Garrett Smith with exuberance. By later that summer, Frederick Jr., age 21, also at his father's behest, went to Mississippi, not as a soldier, but as a recruiter of black troops. There is no evidence that any of the sons had ever shouldered as much as a hunting rifle when growing up in western New York. But off to war they went, and apparently willingly, abandoning earlier interests in emigration from the United States. Their father spoke and wrote proudly of their service and their bravery. "I have implored the imperiled nation to unchain against her foes her powerful black hand," Douglas wrote forcefully on March 21, 1863, in his famous recruiting broadside, Men of Color to Arms. Words are now useful only as they stimulate to blows. But Douglass's effusive public words urging young black men to fly to arms and smite with death the power that would bury the government and your liberty in the same hopeless grave may have masked the private family anguish of a father recruiting his sons to go to war for their reasons as well as his own. It remains to be seen whose manhood was at stake in this family drama, the father's or the son's. We know precious little of what Anna Douglas thought of seeing her sons march off to war where they might easily be enslaved or killed. For Lewis and Charles in particular, their lives were forever altered by their military experience. Sending the middle son, Frederick, to the Deep South, though far more thrilling for him than staying at home, could only have been fraught with anguish as well. Moreover, for most of 1862 and early 1863, the Douglas's daughter, a disgruntled 23-year-old Rosetta, sought independence by boarding in other cities with relatives and abolitionist families, seeking more education and teaching school. All of Anna's children were getting out of the house. The Douglas family, in its own way, went to war. "I have been launched among strange people during the last 6 months," Rosetta wrote to her father in August 1862 from Salem, New Jersey, while living with Anna Douglas's brother, Perry. Earlier, she had stayed in Philadelphia with the Dorsey family, where she said she felt in bondage. Homesick and gloomy, Rosetta seems to have hated Mrs. Dorsey's accusations that Douglas had sent her away to keep her from pursuing young men. In Salem, Rosetta complained of the same treatment. Uncle Perry and Aunt Lizzie both claimed she was sassy and unruly, and that she became their boarder to cure her of growing intimacy with men. Rosetta did find a teaching job, which she relished, reporting that her 50 students all appear to love me. By October, she took extra odd jobs at knitting and embroidery. Rosetta's letters to her father exhibit a deep tenderness, a desperate desire to please, and the tensions in the Douglas household. She repeatedly thanked her father for the money he sent her and craved his affection, writing about their mutual loneliness. I often think of your loneliness, for I well perceive the necessity of congenial companions. I flatter myself, if I were at home, I might in a measure contribute to your happiness, as well as to mother's. Then she observed the problem of the separate worlds of her parents through an impulse of family love. I wish to be all you would have me be, and I wish also to do something to make mother happy, and if both were interested in the same pursuits, it would be much easier for me to be just what I wish to be, a comfort to both parents. According to his daughter, Douglas had tried to instruct all his children in uprightness and character. In apologetic tones, Rosetta admitted she had learned so much from her father. Though I never said much when our table talks were going on, I made resolutions to follow your lessons. Rosetta did remain informed about war news. She also reported on visits from her restless brother, Louis, who was pursuing business. A business card survives, dated as early as 1860, labeled L.H. and F. Douglas, Jr., Groceries and Provisions, on 151 Buffalo Street, Rochester. Rosetta counseled her father not to grow despondent in waiting for Emancipation Day. She was always eager to receive the monthly, read the editor's extraordinary exchange with Postmaster Blair about colonization with keen interest, and by December 28, 1862, longingly wished to read the newspaper reports of the big meeting in Boston on January 1st. One additional part-time guest in the Douglas home did not leave as often as Anna Douglas might have wished. For many summers between the late 1850s and 1872, Otilie Ossing came to Rochester and stayed in the house as Frederick's intellectual and emotional companion. She lived most of the year in Hoboken, New Jersey, and corresponded with her friend regularly. Ossing tried futilely to reshape Douglas's views on various subjects, especially religion, even as she parroted so much of his own rhetoric in essays for her German readers. How this ménage à trois functioned for so long still remains, in part, a mystery. Ossing lived in Rochester for several months at a time, assisting Douglas with the newspaper and writing her own columns for Morgenblatt. He was on the road lecturing for long periods when Ossing may have gone back to New Jersey. Ossing's biographer suggests the two women reached some kind of truce by which the arrangement endured. Although Ossing sipped tea occasionally with Mrs. Douglas, she held Anna in utter contempt, disrespecting her lack of education, and even at times privately denigrating her role as homemaker. As Lee Fought has written, Ossing's annual visits were intrusions on the household, to say the least. In letters to Douglas, Ossing referred to Anna as border state, as the misfitted wife and unnatural impediment in the way of the German woman's designs and alternative views of love and marriage. Ossing hoped that once the war ended, a separation or divorce might finally happen and she might be able to walk tall as the rightful Mrs. Douglas. Ossing and her host were probably lovers, and his response was surely as responsible as her pursuit. But she would be sorely disappointed on the notion of severing the marriage. Perhaps no other home received under its roof a more varied class of people than did our home, wrote Rosetta in an understatement while reminiscing about her mother. Rosetta honored her mother for being frugal, for her great skill as a housekeeper. But as Rosetta pursued a world beyond Rochester, Anna Douglas retreated into her own largely closed world and took charge at home. Anna rebelled in her own way. If a visitor expressed something disagreeable about the house or about Anna herself, that person might be vigorously repelled, remembered the daughter, in a manner more forceful than the said party would deem her capable of. How often this may have happened to the righteously opinionated Ossing, her mind and demeanor preoccupied by literary imagination and with Anna's husband, we can only guess. Anna lived daily life with extreme reserve, said Rosetta. She could not be known all at once. She had to be studied. Such a study repelled Ossing, and Douglas enabled the intruder. Despite all these exciting changes and domestic troubles in the Douglas household, kept entirely hidden in the writer's autobiographies, the winter and spring of 1863 was a time for public glory. a time to reap all the possibilities of what Douglass called the greatest event of the century, the Emancipation Proclamation and the sacred history that flowed from it. The final proclamation included two significant changes from the preliminary. It contained no provisions for colonization, and it called for the recruitment of black men into the Union Armed Forces. The destiny of the American nation had changed forever, Douglass argued. On January 1st, the national ship would now swing round her towering sails, swelled by the trade winds of the Almighty, and she will either be wafted off gloriously to the open sea, or furiously driven by rebellious gales upon the sharp and flinty rocks, only to mark the place of danger to aftercoming voyages. Douglass bet on the glorious open sea, and an Almighty on the side of freedom. In January and much of February 1863, Douglass traveled more than 2,000 miles from Boston to Chicago, and many places in between, attending Jubilee meetings, cautiously anticipating the new war, the new history made possible by the Emancipation. His new standard speech was a tour de force of apocalypticism, moral philosophy, and a thunderous appeal for the enlistment of blacks in the army with equal status. The proclamation, even with its limitations, freeing slaves only in the Confederate States or in occupied areas, brought about a world historical moment, a complete revolution in the position of a nation. The Republic was undergoing a second founding, and Douglass felt more than ready to be one of its fathers. An amazing change was underway, argued Douglass, not only for blacks and for the nation, but for justice throughout the world. We are all liberated by this proclamation, declared the unusually joyous orator. Everybody is liberated. The white man is liberated. The black man is liberated. The brave men now fighting the battles are now liberated. The old nation might now be bludgeoned into ruin, and a new one imagined. Emancipation prompted from Douglass an effusion of millennial faith and expressions of the doctrine of progress. As Michael Walzer has argued, the Jewish and Christian sense of exodus, of a possible liberation through and after affliction and slavery, has been so compelling over time because it is based essentially on a promise. The Exodus story is both so powerful and so adaptable because it is not an account of miracles, of merely waiting for God's intercessions. God will choose moments to intervene, but the great Exodus narrative gets God's people marching, writes Walzer, through the world to a better place in it. Hence, the Old Testament story can be such a source of radical hope if people possess sufficient faith. They can march off with expectation that the world is not all Egypt. Douglass believed events gave evidence that a moral chemistry and an interventionist God now drove history forward. He had rehearsed for this moment for more than 20 years. A prophet issues the warnings and must be ready to reap history's results. Words, faith, inspiration, and an abiding pathos, argues Abraham Heschel, are the prophetic stock in trade. A prophet spares no piety. He is an assaulter of the mind. The words of a true prophet, says Heschel, are a scream in the night, rooted in a sense of history. And timing may be all. With a reasoned scream, Douglass discerned that Babylon might now be falling. I believe in the millennium, the final perfection of the race, declared Douglass in his post-January 1st speech, and hail this proclamation, though wrung out under the goading lash of a stern military necessity. He counseled his large crowds not to dwell on the pronouncement's imperfections. Men may see in it only as a military necessity. To me, it has a higher significance. It is a grand moral necessity. Both moralist and humorist, he entertained as he preached. The mixture of God and history should startle or shock, he argued. A great truth breaks upon the vision of some early riser, said Douglass. And straightway, he wakes up the drowsy world with an announcement of the day and the work. Sleepy people don't like to be disturbed. They hate the troubler, draw their curtains, turn their backs to the light. A century later, James Baldwin may have been channeling Douglass as he observed a new crisis over race and freedom. When Americans reflect on history, Baldwin wrote, words are mostly used to cover the sleeper, not to wake him up. Emancipation in the midst of all-out war was the kind of history that awakened all sleepers. Proof of progress now seemed palpable everywhere. Douglas kept a New York Cooper Institute audience laughing about signs of progress. Only 100 years ago, some Irish, he said, exploiting common prejudices, thought that the proper way to attach a horse to a plow was by the tail. It seemed to them that was what the tail was made for. 200 years back in time, some Christians in the West Indies thought it a sin to baptize persons of color who were slaves because they were property. More recently, he said, right in New England, an older woman who might be a little eccentric and especially gifted stood a smart chance of being hanged as a witch. And just the last few years demonstrated the recent progress that all knew well. Good old John Brown was a madman at Harper's Ferry, pronounced Douglas. 2 years pass away, and the nation is as mad as he is. Measuring progress now became a daily affair. The most revolutionary sign of all was the impending enlistment of black soldiers in the Union Army. The paper proclamation would thus be made iron, lead, and fire. Douglas demanded fair play for black troops, equality in provisions, ranks, and respect. He insisted that they would not only fight, but fight with vengeance. He chided whites to stop calling them niggers and call them soldiers. Give them a chance, he shouted. Then led the audience in repeating the chant with vigor, "Give them a chance." The black soldier would be the redemptive agent of the apocalyptic war. "You have wronged us long and wronged us greatly," Douglas said as though speaking to the nation. "But it is not yet too late to retrieve the past. We still stand ready to serve you, and will do it with a will at the first sound of your war trumpet." In 1863, Douglas did not wait to hear anyone else's trumpet. Massachusetts led the way in the cause of black enlistment, and Governor John Andrew was a staunch anti-slavery Republican and worked vigorously to convince the Lincoln administration to allow him to mobilize black troops. In January 1863, he received authorization from Secretary of War Edwin Stanton to recruit a regiment. Stanton promised equal pay and treatment for black soldiers, but denied Andrew's request for black commissioned officers. Although Stanton did not keep all his promises, and the denial of officers' rank caused deep resentments, the recruiting began for the famous 54th Massachusetts Infantry Regiment. The Massachusetts legislature paid for recruiters and to transport troops, and Andrew called on the wealthy Boston abolitionist George Luther Stearns to direct the recruiting. For the remainder of the war, Stearns devoted himself and a fair portion of his fortune to the cause of black enlistment. Stearns quickly established recruiting posts all across the North and enlisted as agents a who's who of black abolitionists: Douglas, Charles Lennox Ramon, John Mercer Langston, William Wells Brown, Henry Highland Garnett, and Martin Delaney. Friends, but mostly Douglas's rivals. Stearns paid Douglas's expenses at $10 per week, less than what the editor thought his services were worth. Although he uttered no public objection, he did complain privately about his compensation. Douglas threw himself into recruiting with electric energy. Massachusetts, he declared, was not only the most direct way to the heart of our slaveholding rebellion, but she is the colored man's way to political and civil liberty. The historic link between soldiering and citizenship had never before been given such an open door. Douglas's task was to convince black men to march through it. And march they did. The 54th Massachusetts was a national black regiment with members from 15 northern states, all 4 border states, 5 Confederate states, and some from Canada and the West Indies. They were overwhelmingly free-born blacks, although at least 30 men in the regiment's ranks were former slaves. The men of the 54th formed a remarkable cross-section of working-class black life in America. 51 barbers, 38 seamen, 34 waiters, 27 boatmen, 24 teamsters, and 2 peddlers signed up. The ranks included 1 cabinet maker, a dentist, and a druggist. Five called themselves students, and only one preacher enlisted among the original 1,007. 27 strong joined in New Bedford, Massachusetts. One of their number, a bright and literate 26-year-old seaman named James H. Gooding, would write a series of weekly letters to the hometown newspaper, providing that community a rich record of the regiment's story until his death after 5 months in Andersonville Prison in Georgia in July 1864. James Caldwell, the grandson of Sojourner Truth, enlisted from Battle Creek, Michigan. 38 men over 40 years old served in the regiment, the oldest of whom, at 46, was Peter Vogelsang, a clerk from Brooklyn, New York. The recruits underwent a rigorous medical examination, and doctors rejected nearly one out of three men. Douglas first met with Stearns in late February. They launched their frantic crusade together. Within days, Douglas issued his broadside, Men of Color to Arms. Stearns's correspondence with Douglas took on a breathless quality as he, Stearns, tallied the numbers by town and region and gave instructions about the price to pay for transport. Can send in second-class cars at $3 each. Which railroads were cooperating with free fares and which were hostile. At some junctions, they had constant fear of disturbance. No one in America, even in modestly anti-slavery upstate New York, had ever seen anything like this. Groups of boisterous black men, often singing, riding the cars and strutting through train stations on their way to take up arms for their country. Charles Douglas proudly remembered having the honor of being the first to enroll at Rochester for the 54th Massachusetts Infantry, February 9th, 1863. Soldiers never forget those dates. Similarly, his older brother, Lewis, wrote with equal pride to his sweetheart, Amelia Logan, in late March, that he had been appointed a non-commissioned sergeant major. He described the 17 recruits with whom he left Syracuse as his men. They rode the first-class cars, and on the way to Binghamton, my men amused themselves by singing John Brown. Lewis's chest swelled as he wrote from camp, wearing his new uniform. He felt respected and a sense of honor as never before. "I have enlisted for 3 years or during the war," he told Amelia. "I am thought a good deal of here." By mid-April, Douglas had sent more than 100 men off to Reedville, Massachusetts, just outside Boston, the training site of the 54th. He barnstormed the cities and towns of western New York and the Hudson Valley, as well as made special trips to New York City and Philadelphia to address large recruiting meetings. It is a telling scene to imagine Douglas standing before gatherings of blacks, exhorting his people to grasp the opportunity to get guns and uniforms and go fight. Many of these people had heard Douglas before in a church or a hall, but never on this subject. Douglas's listeners were wary and sometimes openly distrustful. Would black soldiers really be treated fairly in the Union Army? What would happen if they got sick or were captured? Who would lead them? Men born free in the North had never been in the slave states of the South. For people who had lived lives of skepticism or outright contempt for the federal government, why should they trust Douglas's promises? At times, though, the great orator's appeals to patriotism, flag, and self-interest must have been irresistible. At the end of some of his recruiting speeches, he broke into song and led the assembled in John Brown's Body, the early versions of which contained the lyrics, "He's gone to be a soldier in the army of the Lord, his soul's marching on. John Brown's knapsack is strapped upon his back, his soul's marching on." Douglas invited his audiences to participate, dream, and sing in a story now both old and new. Douglas recruited 25 men in Syracuse, and 23 more followed him away from Glens Falls, Little Falls, and Canajoharie. The orator personally escorted some of the volunteers all the way to the 54th's encampment in Reedville. One company, unable to secure rail transport, walked 360 miles from Elmira, New York, to Boston. In such small black communities, this recruitment comprised a relative exodus of men and left emotions sizzling as well as troubled. In some places, Douglas was less successful. The war had caused near full employment, even among blacks. Privately, Douglas admitted to some hesitation about black enlistment due to the denial of officer's status. But for the moment, he told Garrett Smith, blacks should hail the opportunity of getting on the United States uniform as a very great advance. Publicly, Douglas counseled, action. Action, not criticism. Words are now useful only as they stimulate to blows. Men of Color to Arms was mass-produced across the North. Published in a different version as an editorial in the March 1863 issue of the Monthly, the broadside was distinctively Douglas's own. Despite his call to martial action, rhetoric, as always, remained his weapon. He called black men to service almost as an archangel, a Gabriel with trumpet, delivering an oracle, calling men to step forward and join this epic of their own liberation. Douglas crafted the broadside in terse pronouncements. To arms, now or never. This is our golden moment. A model of other such broadsides, the recruiting poster was a manifesto of martial spirit and manliness. He employed the word manhood four times, and made the case for enlistment as one of bravery versus cowardice. Douglas asked black men to offer their selfless blood for country, family, and their future citizenship and equality. Although Douglas would never lead the volunteers on actual battlefields, his son Louis did, it was as if the recruiting speeches allowed him to deliver his own brand of a St. Crispin's Day speech. This story shall the good man teach his son, declares Henry V. We few, we happy few, we band of brothers, for he today that sheds his blood with me shall be my brother. In the broadside and in recruiting speeches, Douglas addressed his audiences as brothers and fathers. The war had become a special affair of black fraternity and manhood. In his more discursive editorial, Douglas personalized the appeal, asking directly for the potential soldiers' trust in his promises of equal wages, rations, equipments, due to his 20 years of unswerving devotion to the cause of abolition. This is your hour and mine, he invoked not only the history of Massachusetts anti-slavery activism, but especially the great black heroes. Remember Denmark Vesey of Charleston. Remember Nathaniel Turner of Southampton. Remember Shields, Green, and Copeland, who followed noble John Brown and fell as glorious martyrs. He reached for their hearts. The day dawns. The morning star is bright upon the horizon, sang the messenger. The iron gate of our prison stands half open. One gallant rush from the north will fling it wide open, while 4 millions of our brothers and sisters shall march out into liberty. Here was a biblical vision of a jubilee, and a prison metaphor as powerful as any others in his writing. At every stop on the recruiting tour, Douglas offered volunteers an elaborate list of reasons to enlist, both practical and emotionally stirring. The practical ends included self-defense through learning the use of arms, self-respect by demonstrating the courage and manhood of blacks, self-involvement by making their own history and destiny, and finally the ultimate act of self-interest, retribution against slaveholders on behalf of their race. Recruiting provided Douglas an enhanced opportunity to vent his own rage against slaveholders. He could now invite young men to do the work of slaying them. The long-awaited chance had arrived. Now the government has given authority to black men to shoulder a musket and go down and kill white rebels. For so long he had yearned for such sanctioned killing of slaveholders. Like any clever propagandist, though, he kept his image of the enemy simple, never bothering to acknowledge that most Southern soldiers were non-slaveholders. Finally, Douglas demanded that black men strike the blow for citizenship rights. To fight for the government in this tremendous war, Douglas claimed, is to fight for nationality and for a place with all other classes of our fellow citizens. He tried to sow the deepest seeds of nationalism in his recruits by linking black patriots of the Civil War with their white counterparts in the American Revolution. The white man's soul was tried in 1776, wrote Douglas. The black man's is tried in 1863. The first stood the test and is received as genuine, so may the last. Douglas boldly promised great dividends from sacrifice. He contended that once a black man could get upon his person the brass letters U.S., an eagle on his button, and a musket on his shoulder, and bullets in his pocket, there is no power on earth which can deny that he has earned the right of citizenship in the United States. Douglas advocated a gallant rush of black men into uniform. They were now shining symbols, liberating warriors who alone made suffering meaningful. Transforming this conflict into a black people's war demanded such great leaps of faith, even as sober history in retrospect tells us that sweet reason, moral truth, and blood sacrifice by themselves have never defeated racism. Lewis and Charles certainly caught the spirit their father preached. Lewis wrote with pride from Camp Meigs about how the men of the 54th were becoming proficient in the manual of arms. With an older brother's protective condescension, he observed that Charlie, in charge of a company, needed to learn how to boss his men around. Lewis also celebrated how the men were kicking up their heels as colored persons, laughing in our peculiar style. For good reason, though, Lewis was worried about his brother. In early May, the youthful Charles got into an altercation with another soldier and had to be restrained. Worse, Charles was sick in the hospital within a week of the regiment's departure for the South and would be left behind in camp. This began a long pattern of illness, disappointment, and complaint by Charles. On July 6th, with his regiment at the front in the Sea Islands of South Carolina, Charles wrote to his father about yet another altercation he'd experienced with an Irishman who called him a black nigger on a street in Boston. "I felt as though I could whip a dozen Irish," said the immature 18-year-old soldier boy, who felt lost and abused in his troubled adventure. The Douglas boy's father came for day visits at Camp Meigs during two consecutive weeks in May, and was much pleased at Lewis's appearance. According to one observer, during a visit Douglas gave one of his soul-stirring addresses to the assembled troops. Anna and Rosetta also visited for at least a week in May, staying with a friend in Boston, and coming out to the camp to watch the troops train every day. This was an extraordinary trip for Anna. It must have been a special, if bittersweet, joy for her to join in the festival of gawking tourists who went to watch the black men march and perform with rifles. Above all, Lewis fed his beloved Amelia Logan a steady diet of patriotism and florid soldierly devotion. He had read his father's prose, "Remember that if I fall, that it is in the cause of humanity," he told his girl-in-waiting, "that I am striking a blow for the welfare of the most abused and despised race on the face of the earth." Lewis dwelt on his possible death, but with a wide-eyed bravado. "Do not think of me enduring hardships. Do not think of me grappling with that non-respecter of persons, death. Think of me as aiding the glorious work of bursting loose those chains which keep the husbands, wives, children, lovers, and friends of millions asunder, as aiding to overthrow a system which degrades millions of human beings." Eager to go south, Lewis sent Amelia his photograph, showing him in his blue uniform, and begged her never to be ashamed of it. The Union Army had no more devoted soldier, especially before seeing combat. For 2.5 months in the spring of 1863, the 54th Regiment slowly but surely assembled at Camp Meigs. As their commander, Governor Andrew personally selected Robert Gould Shaw, the 25-year-old son of a wealthy New York-Boston family. His parents, Francis George and Sarah Blake Shaw, were radical abolitionists. A child of fortune, Shaw had traveled to Europe for education as a teenager and attended Harvard from 1856 to 1859, but quit before graduating. In his time abroad, the youthful Shaw had been a profligate, indulgent party boy, and, contrary to his parents, indifferent to, if not contemptuous of, abolitionism. At the outbreak of the war, bored in a job given him by an uncle in a mercantile business, Shaw enlisted in the 7th New York Militia, and then in the 2nd Massachusetts, in which he served as a first lieutenant, and fought in the battles of Winchester, Cedar Mountain, and Antietam in 1862. At first, Shaw turned down the command of the 54th Massachusetts, but war and leadership had matured him, and he quickly changed his mind and accepted the challenge. In one of his long letters to his father from the front, Shaw described the scene around him on the night after the horror at Antietam. At last, night came on, all was quiet. The crickets chirped and the frogs croaked, just as if nothing unusual had happened all day long. And presently the stars came out bright, and we lay down among the dead, and slept soundly until daylight. There were 20 dead bodies within a rod of me. Once promoted to colonel, Shaw took to his new appointment commanding the Black Regiment with genuine zeal. When he barked out orders, his matured voice carried the grim weight of those scenes at Antietam. The training at Readville was at times notoriously tough, and the discipline rigid. By the middle of May, the regiment's ranks were full. On May 18th, several special train cars carried a host of dignitaries on the Providence and Boston line down to Readville for the 54th's presentation of colors. Douglas joined his old disaffected mentors, William Lloyd Garrison and Wendell Phillips, among numerous Boston abolitionists. Whether the two rival editors actually had much conversation is not recorded. Garrison had now become a robust supporter of the war effort and Lincoln's proclamation, an irony Douglas enjoyed. With the entire regiment drawn up in ranks and a large crowd watching, Governor Andrew delivered a long, deeply Christian speech. As he presented to Shaw the regimental and American flags, Andrew instructed the men in their sacred charge. The whole world would be watching them vindicate their race. They were to fight not merely for state and country, but for humanity, and for the religion of our Lord itself. Their mission would only fail when the last patriot, the last philanthropist, and the last Christian shall have tasted death. In words oft quoted since in melodramatic depictions of this famous regiment's destiny, the governor declared the highest stakes. I know not, Mr. Commander, where in all human history, to any given 1,000 men in arms, there has been committed a work at once so proud, so precious, so full of hope and glory as the work committed to you. The stakes were high. In camp, Lewis Douglas wondered again after the ceremony about whether he would ever come home alive, adding tersely that the governor would never have reason to regret the steps he has taken in raising the regiment. War stories begin, but rarely end, with flag ceremonies. On May 28th, the regiment arrived early in the morning in Boston for their public departure for South Carolina. Led by a sprightly band and with Shaw on horseback at their lead, the men of the 54th marched a circuitous route of Boston streets. Thousands lined the route, cheering and waving flags. As the regiment passed the house of Wendell Phillips, Garrison stood on its balcony, his hand resting on a bust of John Brown. As they passed 44 Beacon Street, with its balcony graced by Shaw's mother, four sisters, and newly married wife, Annie, Shaw halted and kissed his sword. He had learned theater and romance as well as war. The troops turned left into Boston Commons at Charles Street, and formally paraded for nearly an hour in front of a viewing stand, as huge crowds of people roared huzzas on all sides, some waving handkerchiefs and others a souvenir containing the Byron quote, "Those who would be free themselves must strike the first blow." The 54th exited the common and marched to the Battery Wharf with a band playing John Brown's Body. No one who witnessed this event would ever forget what they saw that day. 1,000 smartly stepping black men with Enfield rifles, leaning forward gracefully, moving as one body toward history, heroism, and death, to prove to their slaveholding country that they were indeed truly men. The witnesses were privileged to see not only what would become an iconic moment of American military history, but a spectacular, if genuinely tragic, illustration of both the agony and the potential transcendence of this second revolution. Some family members and friends mingled with the soldiers at the dock as they prepared to board the big new steamer, De Molay. Douglas himself joined the state's adjutant general, William Schuyler, and a few others on board the ship, and rode with the men out until it had almost cleared Boston Harbor. At nearly dusk, the father civilian could go no farther, said his emotional farewells to his son Louis, as well as to many other men he had recruited, and was assisted down onto a tugboat that returned him to shore. Each man on that ship had his own private joys and fears to ponder. As Frederick and Louis Douglas watched each other fade into the harbor's dimming light, their minds and hearts swelled with the unspeakable love and dreadful anxiety that war creates in fathers and sons. The great man of words left us no statement of his thoughts that memorable night. On June 3rd, the De Molay arrived in the vicinity of Hilton Head Island and made its way up the Port Royal inlet. Early on the morning of June 4th, the regiment came ashore in Beaufort, South Carolina, a beautiful town now occupied by Union forces and officials. The men of the 54th spent several days bivouacked at Beaufort, now a teeming depot of war, working essentially as laborers. Louis reveled that in this hub of military activity, he met not only Robert Smalls, the famous former slave who had stolen and piloted a Confederate boat out of Charleston to freedom, but Harriet Tubman herself, who, as Louis put it, is a captain of a group of men who pilot the Union forces into the enemy's country. Soon the regiment was dispatched to St. Simon's Island on the Georgia coast, where they became embroiled in a brutal and controversial attack on the town of Darien. The 54th, against Shaw's vehement protests, were ordered to destroy and burn houses and resources in the town. Louis tried to write soberly about such duty, but failed. They could discover no enemy, he reported, and lifted a fortune in goods from private houses. The women we left after burning every building or shelter in the place to the ground. I felt a little sympathy for the feminines. Southern newspapers called the 54th Massachusetts accursed Yankee vandals and cowardly Negro thieves. The 54th's young commander chafed to get his men into combat next to white troops to prove their skill and bravery. The regiment spent at least 3 weeks encamped on St. Simon's, with rations dwindling and morale damaged by bizarre rumors that the government was going to take their rifles away and arm them only with pikes. Finally, on July 9th through 11th, they were transported to James Island at Charleston Harbor. Union forces under General Quincy A. Gilmore began a constant bombardment of Fort Wagner, which guarded the entrance to the harbor and therefore to the prize itself, Charleston. While on picket duty at dawn on July 16th, the 54th was frontally attacked by approximately 900 Confederates. They had to retreat, but ultimately held their ground valiantly in this their first combat action. On that day, they lost 14 killed, 18 wounded, and 13 missing. Louis survived unhurt. Shaw was ordered to bring his men as quickly as possible across mudflats and swamps for an impending infantry assault on Battery Wagner, an impregnable, well-armed fortress built of palmetto logs, stone, sand dunes, and abatis near the northern tip of Morris Island, with Fort Sumter and the mouth of the Great Harbor looming behind it. Marching for 8 hours overnight, often in a relentless thunderstorm, on wooden planks and in swamp water to their knees, the regiment reached a safe open beach where they rested. By the night of the 17th, a steamer ferried them across an inlet onto Morris Island, where they could see their challenge. Asked if he wanted his men to lead the assault, Shaw gladly assented. One of Gilmore's generals was heard to say, "Put those damned Negroes from Massachusetts in advance. We may as well get rid of them, one time or another." Shaw looked at his exhausted, hungry, but determined men, and in the early evening of July 18th, at about 600 yards from the fort, ordered the black soldiers to form two lines of battle, fix bayonets, and lie on the sand. With the sound of the ocean waves lapping up just to their right, the men scratched notes and letters, told one another where and to whom to send them if they died, and prepared for their hour of truth. Shaw said to his second-in-command, Ned Halliwell, I shall go in advance of the men with the national flag. It will give the men something to rally around. We shall take the fort or die there. Shaw stepped out front at about 7:45 p.m. and gave an